Welcome to the Coming Home Well podcast, the show that educates, supports, and advocates for the veteran community. Your host, Dr. Tyler Piron, U.S. Army retired, will bring you exciting conversations with amazing guests about resources, research, and military history, all geared to helping our warriors to come home well. Here's your host, Dr. Tyler Piron.
Welcome back to Coming Home. Well, I'm your host, Tyler Piron, and today we have a really interesting guest, and it's somebody who I find really interesting because he was a combat engineer, and as people that know me well, I was a combat engineer the first part of my career. It was a lot of hard work. It was not the most fun, except it was the most fun. It was one of those interesting, like, it sucks while you're there, and then afterwards you're like, I had the most fun in the entire Army. I was blowing stuff up. And then you forget about the miles of pickets and the razor wire tearing up everything. So we have Lieutenant Dan Joseph. He's a now former Army combat engineer, a sapper platoon leader who shipped out to basic training at age 32. Let me tell you, folks, 32 is not a spring chicken in the combat engineer world. He was stationed at Fort Irwin during the lockdowns during COVID, and where he focused on maintaining the mental health of his troops while wargaming in the desert. Imagine that. You're in COVID, getting locked down, and have to go train. Well, that's the Army, isn't it? His life changed. One of his soldiers survived a suicide attempt, while at the same time, his best friend in the military lost 13 men in his unit due to suicide. Working closely and sparring jiu-jitsu with several combat veterans brought deeper awareness about the psychological weight they carried each day, making it that much clearer how important healthy leadership is. Obtaining a master's in organizational psychology while in uniform helped him explore the neuroscience of good leadership. He wrote a book on mental health and resilience for new leaders based on advice given by several friends, including officers and enlisted service members of every branch, ranging from pilots to special operators. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Coming Home Well.
Wow, that intro. Thank you. I just need a moment to collect myself. That was pretty cool. I mean, I appreciate you taking so much time to learn about me, and the way you said it makes me sound a lot cooler than I really am. So,
you know, we want everybody to be, you know, jazzed about their service there, because whether you're a cook, a laundry and bath specialist, or supply, or the most secret special agent Delta operator, it all matters. And so many folks, you know, always want to hype up who they are. Like, you know, like, I remember a quote, a guy that served in Vietnam as a Navy SEAL. He said, 500 SEALs served in Vietnam, and I've met all 20,000 of them. So every job's important. And as a combat engineer, I understand what goes into that. It's one of the few jobs that I've had the opportunity to do. That's one of the things I love about the Army, is that you can do lots of cool stuff. And being a combat engineer is one of them. You get to go blow stuff up, learn how demo works. And then you also have, like I talked about, all the other things like obstacles and wire and landmines and placing things and carrying heavy things and building bridges and all sorts of nonsense. So you're out at Fort Irwin. And for folks that aren't familiar, it's the National Training Center. It's where the Army goes and plays the big war games before you deploy. It's kind of like the final check before you go to make sure that everything's set. You've got everything trained. And the commanders get graded on it. So they are stressed out, especially if things aren't going well. It's a huge desert. It's out in California. And it is one of the least chosen places to get stationed, other than Fort Hood, maybe. But among it's pretty close. So, Dan, you were out there. Tell us first how you got in the Army at age 32. That's an unusual thing.
So, like you said, some of these people that I wrote about in the book, they really inspired me before I joined to finally sign a contract. And I was working in the biotech sector before I shipped out, was running my own business, and it was cool. I mean, I was working in the nascent stages of what is now AI. So back then it was neural networks and things of that sort, where basically these scientists were kind of like stringing together a bunch of different computers and spitting out genetic code, or testing genetic code on different algorithms that they were creating to look for diseases and biomarkers. So I was in a very nerdy space, which I love because I'm a huge nerd. And after working pretty successfully in that private little company that I owned, I was catering to some awesome scientists and getting them jobs and sort of like an agent for them, if you will. And, you know, I had buddies who were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan during that same time period. And so while I was at the beach here in San Diego, enjoying myself, enjoying American freedom and safety and all the beautiful things our nation has to offer, my buddies were coming back from deployments at a pretty high op tempo. A lot of them were Navy SEALs. There were some pilots that I was friends with, EOD techs as well. And they were coming back telling me about some stories where, you know, it was a close shave and they were oftentimes thinking about their wife and kids, not thinking they're going to make it back out of a firefight. And it just gave me this sincere awareness of how comfortable my life was because of folks like them. And I talk about it in the book. My parents are actually refugees, essentially from Iraq is how we pronounce it. They left in the 70s. And so growing up, you know, during the wars in the Middle East, I was given this awareness through my parents' lens and how they perceived the world of how dangerous it was growing up there, how unpredictable and how blessed and lucky we are to be in America. I was born in the States, so I was able to have a freedom that my parents, you know, dreamt of when they were younger. And so, again, these service members were going back to fight these battles and wars in places where my family grew up and escaped from, really. So that kind of added weight and compelled me to put on a uniform and at least tell myself, you know, before I die and leave this world that I did it. It was one of those moments where I thought, who do I want to be, like, you know, on my deathbed. It's kind of I don't want to be morbid, but that really led me to just say, I've got to sign a contract. You know, I can't just sit here making my life about money and what I'm doing now. I want to be able to say that I've done it. And so I did.
Something a little 32. Bigger, a little more bigger than yourself. Is that it?
Yeah. It felt really selfish where I was at, for sure. That was eating me alive, to be honest.
So you're in San Diego and there's a lot of Navy in San Diego, and I can't think of any Army units anywhere near San Diego. So how did that happen?
There's a few little secret squirrely things going on here with the Army, but I won't talk about that. Well, I was debating which branch to join. And I mean, it took a while. I was so confused. The Marines told me I was too old. So that door closed and that helped me out. But when it came to the Navy, I'm not really great in the water. So I think that's kind of what did it for me, is I wanted to be in a group, you know, of badasses like my buddies who are SEALs and whatnot, EODs. But what made sense to me, it was after I met a Green Beret and we hung out. His brother's an EOD in the Navy. But he and I wrote about him in the book and the advice he gave me, but he really opened my eyes to the Army because it was the least familiar branch to me, because there's Marine Corps here, there's Navy, there's a few Air Force guys. But yeah, we talked about the Army, we talked about the mission sets and where things were going. And I thought, hey, this could be a great place to start and, you know, maybe test out a different branch later if it didn't work out. But I thought I'd love to start off as a soldier and, you know, experience it that way. And next thing I knew, I was going to basic training at Fort Jackson.
You know, it's, I was sort of thinking about what you were saying, and that makes perfect sense. I mean, nobody grows up and plays Navy. Okay. They play soldier, they play Army. No, I'm just kidding. You know, I love my other services, but I always joke and I'm like, you know, if I could do it all over again, I would have gone Air Force. But I've been around the Army since I was 17. So, you know, I have this love of the Army. I love the people, love the organization, though I am fully aware of every flaw. And you have to understand that, you know, just because you appreciate the organization and what it does and the opportunities it gives you, doesn't mean you have to like overlook all the other things. And so it's definitely a different approach. So you sit there, you join. You go to Fort Jackson. I was actually at Fort Jackson. My wife and I met there. We spent time there about a year and a half. And actually, we met before, but we were stationed together at Fort Jackson. And then I like Fort Jackson, but it is a interesting, it is a small microcosm of the Army. It's a little bit different. Now, normally engineers go to Fort Leavenworth. So I was interested.
Fort Leonard Wood.
Yeah. Yep. Fort Leonard Wood out there in Missouri. I remember celebrating the last time that I went, knowing it would be the last time I would be there. St. George is the little town outside of Leonard Wood. It's a different, little town. I actually did a crime survey there because I was, you know, I was a CID agent. We do training and it's a population of 2,800 and there were 34 strip bars. I counted them and I visited every one at the time. It was definitely an Army town. So why Jackson? How'd you end up there?
So Fort Jackson was just, it was one of the basic training spots that they were sending new recruits out to. So I shipped out, it could have been there, Fort Benning. Well, Fort Moore now, but it was Fort Benning then. But yeah, I went to Jackson just for, you know, 2-3 months, whatever the duration of basic training, and then immediately went to OCS. So that was in Georgia. And then after OCS, that's where we had a branch, you know, we had to pick our branches or get, you know, picked depending on where you ranked in the class of 160 students. There's a OML order of merit list. And, you know, the top of the class got their first pick. And then it also depended on what jobs were available for that class. But long story short, I branched engineer and then immediately after that went to Fort Leonard Wood, in Missouri. And after Fort Leonard Wood, yeah, all my buddies were getting their orders to ship out. And I thought, I was like, dude, I joined the Army, going to Afghanistan for sure, or Iraq. And then they told me I'm going to California. And I thought it was a joke because I did not know there was an Army base in California, not until I graduated Bullock. So engineer, you know, basic officer leadership course. Once I graduated, then I suddenly became aware there's a base in California. And the whole point of joining the military, my eyes, was to go to the Middle East and go check it out and see what my parents were so scared of over there, you know? And then, yeah, I went to a non-deployable unit. So that was kind of a bummer. But all in all, I got to be close to the soldiers there. And, you know, in an environment like that, it's the Joes next to you that make it, you know?
So you wanted to deploy. They send you to Fort Irwin, to the National Training Center. And then the pandemic happens. That must have totally changed the dynamic, the environment. I know it changed it, you know, in my life. I know it. No one I know is unaffected by it. How did it affect the guys that are kind of geographically isolated? You know, it's an hour to the nearest store. It's, you know, you've got the base and that's about it.
Yeah.
How did that affect everybody?
I mean, it felt like a fob is what everyone told me who's been Afghanistan, right? So I remember talking to just a group of NCOs, actually independently of one another, but I was just trying to make sense of the situation as we all were, you know. Everyone's trying to do the best they could, but I talked to a few combat vets and they were like, hey man, this is exactly what a fob feels like right now. And they had talked about, we talked extensively about mental health. And because I was concerned, you know, I saw some things and, you know, around the world, people were suffering. This isn't just on my base or just in the military, right? This was a global impact, but I was just very keenly aware of what was going on from my purview. And the best thing you could do as a new officer is talk to the NCOs, right? Because I've been in for what, a year and a half? And then all these NCOs next to me have been in multiple wars for over a decade. So I started leaning on them for my own support, my own sanity. And they really shared with me the comparison between being deployed and what our base felt like. They gave me some advice on how I can treat the soldiers, what I could do to encourage them. I asked them, you know, how did you decompress? What did you do between patrols? So yeah, I was just trying to pick their brains, you know, and apply anything I could learn in real time. But yeah, it was definitely rough because like jujitsu is my medicine. You know, I don't really have too many vices right now. I stopped partying. I stopped a lot of stuff younger in my 20s. So when I joined the military, I actually didn't drink a drop during the lockdowns. I just worked out 3 times a day. But I really missed rolling jujitsu and having community that way. So it was just all of us were searching for answers on how to best decompress and handle our own issues. You know? It was quite a gnarly chapter. That's why I wrote a book. This was all helping me process the ups and downs of it.
So let's talk about the book a little bit. And I mentioned it in your intro a little bit. You had a soldier that attempted suicide, didn't fail, I guess, which is the death. You never want to call it a success. I mean, but that's, a successful suicide means someone dies. And that always sounds like backwards to me. They failed positively. So they attempted suicide, and I'm sure it had a huge effect on you and all the Joes next to them. How did that sort of metamorphosize into a book?
Well, so his name's Cody, and he's alive and well today. He's out of the military now, and we're still in touch. It's one of those things you just when you have battle buddies, right? You don't expect it to be a lifelong thing, but you're just kind of committed to each other, to check in on each other and stuff. So after I got out, so when Cody told me about, his attempt, and disclosed it, and we got him help, immediately. I spoke with his mother that day, let her know that we were getting him help. I remember looking at him thinking, and I told him, I was like, dude, why would you try to take yourself out of this world, man? Like, you're a good dude. This would suck if you weren't standing in front of me right now, breathing. I think I explicitly said that. And I just told him, I'm glad you're here. We're going to get you help. And I told him, in my mind, I was seeing him, right, standing in front of me. But I was thinking, like, man, I could be at this guy's funeral. I could have been standing in front of his coffin. And because I know that happened to several of my friends with their buddies that they served with, right? So I couldn't take it for granted that he was still alive. And yeah, it really impacted me. I didn't realize how much until I got out. Once I got out, there was a lot more stuff bottled inside than I expected. It actually started coming out in jiu-jitsu, the aggression and whatnot. And luckily, one of my coaches is a veteran. So he helped guide me through that by punching me in the face with love. Not really, but he choked me out quite well. But no, we worked through those issues. But, he told me, he's like, look, now that you're out, a lot of stuff's going to come up. You're different. You're a veteran now. Last time you were in the world, you were a civilian. He said, naturally, you're going to have more aggression. You're going to have more stuff that's going to come out. So I'll be a resource for you. If you need me on the mats, let me know. And then I started a journal entry about Cody, about the fact that, do I deserve, it's hard to say. It's a weird situation. Like, why do I deserve, I don't want to say this in a dark way, but he's alive. And I have a soldier who's alive who could have been gone. But my other buddies, they lost their brothers in arms, right? So what made me lucky and them not? And I started, and this is a convoluted, expansive discussion to have. And I started getting deep with it and started journaling. And that journal entry turned into a 400-page book where I'm just basically trying to reflect on the good stuff, the positive stuff that my friends have given me, the wisdom that they've shared throughout the years that hopefully allowed me to be a leader in Cody's eyes, that, he would see some highlights, right? I'm not perfect. It stemmed from the wisdom that was given me from my friends, So let's talk
about the book. It's called Backpack to Rucksack, Insight into Leadership and Resiliency from Military Experts. That's a big mouthful of a book, but I love the fact that you talk about resiliency. We talk a lot about that because, it was a kind of a buzzword in the military for a while. They had all these campaigns, but moral injury is a big thing. Mm-hmm. Resiliency is a big thing that I don't think gets quite nearly as much attention, because the dynamics have changed. I've been around the Army for a long time. Mm-hmm. And mental health used to be, like a pariah. If you had mental health issues, you were broken and worthless. And people would do absolutely everything to avoid going to the mental health folks. Everything. And so people would lie on their deployment sheets. Did you see this? Did you see that? No, I never saw anything. How much do you drink? Oh, I have one drink like a month. Meanwhile, that guy drinks that's a fifth a night. They lie, and people do it for a lot of reasons. Now, it has changed. It is much more open to, hey, I need help. I need to go talk to somebody. And it's not like a bad thing. In fact, I've especially with the younger folks that I work with, it's a very common, hey, I'm going to go, I have an appointment with my counselor this afternoon, so I won't be in. Like, that would have never happened in the past, ever. Like, oh, I have a doctor's appointment. Like, you would have admitted going to the proctologist for, you know, something on your butt before you'd admit you're going to mental health. And it's changed, and it's awesome, and it's good. But resiliency is kind of like in between those two things. And that's why I like the fact that your book talks about it, because it's like something you can do, and it's really a attitude and altitude, how you approach things. So what does the book go into?
So basically, I talk about resiliency. I give a list of best practices, some practical advice people can use. And essentially I detail it as a way of preemptively offloading stress from the brain. I like to kind of dabble in the neurophysiology of it as well and give people context to understand that our brain has a certain capacity for stress. And then once it's overloaded, unless you have a way to throttle that back down or kind of have a pressure release valve, that is just going to stay there. You know, it's going to stay locked in the body physiologically. And so it's important that we have self-care techniques or ways to manage incoming stress in such a way that we can kind of give ourselves more buffer time. And that's essentially the key to resilience from what I perceived. It's not like you can stop stress from coming in or trauma or war or whatever it is, right? But what you can do is if we kind of proactively invest in our service members, we can allow them to have a stronger, more resilient, or I guess more robust resiliency. And that really has to do with the homework before the issue starts, ideally. You know, so we teach them about mindfulness, understanding how their body is currently. Do they have injuries? Do they have pain points? What are their current stress levels? Who's stressing them out? Are they self-medicating? Is there something they're dissociating from? I mean, these are, again, each one of these topics can be huge, right? Especially if they've come into the military with pre-existing trauma, whether it's child abuse or neglect, abandonment, anything like that. You know, you throw a war on top of that, that's just gas on the fire. But what I'd like to do, what I did as a leader is I was in the field a lot with my Joes, right? So I try to get my finger on the pulse and ask them, how's things at home with your wife or your husband? How's your kids doing? How's your education? Are you seeking any education right now to enrich your life? You know, especially during the lockdowns, I was trying to see what hope they had other than just go out to the field and bang out pickets and deal with the desert. Right. And I wanted to let them know that self enrichment is a worthy investment, because the stronger the individual soldier is, the stronger the unit, the stronger the army will be. And so it flies in the face of that kind of stigma from going to behavioral health and being perceived as being broken. Rather than have that perspective, I think we should look at people as more of a reliable asset. You know, you wouldn't look at a weapon or a vehicle that you're maintaining as a weak vehicle or a weak weapon. So we should have the same perspective with the mindset of the soldiers. That's how I'd boil it down. And again, it's proactive. That's where resiliency is really foundational.
One of the things I really liked about this approach is it's a lot of emphasis on leadership. And as we know that, you know, you can't get really fired, you can get chaptered, but you know, it's hard to get fired from the military. But your life can be made a living hell with bad leaders. And there's a lot of commonality, and there's a million ways to be a bad leader. And there's a million ways to be a good leader. But there's some commonalities about giving a crap about the people that are doing it, not just, oh, number seven or number eight. You know, like, I don't know. I don't need to know your names because you'll be moving along. I don't care. You know, the people that invest in their folks always have a better team, always have better results, and the people are better set up. So I know you talked about jiu-jitsu. And I have lots of friends who are like big, and everybody that I know that does jiu-jitsu is big into jiu-jitsu. There is like no half measures. Were you able to incorporate that while you were deployed and during COVID, I guess it was shut down. How did that all play a part into it?
Yeah, I mean, there was some underground little fight clubs that we had, but
I figured.
Yeah, it's hard to stop the tribe from meeting, but it definitely was not as frequent and reliable, especially with the op tempo and stuff going on. Yeah, but you know, the principles that we learned on the mats definitely apply to leadership, you know, staying calm, right? Because you can't freak out if you're getting choked out by someone, you're just going to black out faster. You know, you got to control your breathing, stay calm. It's basically, you got to slow down the amygdala, the hippocampus, brain, basically all the
fight or flight.
The fight or flight. Yeah, you got to slow down that limbic response, and you've got to turn on the prefrontal cortex to stay technical and have the appropriate response to the situation. Well, same thing applies if you're dealing with an angry soldier, or you know, vehicles malfunctioning or equipment malfunctioning or whatever it is, right? We're doing some sketchy convoy movements in the middle of the night. We're doing stuff that can get pretty dangerous pretty quick out there. And so you know, tempers can fly. And so it's really important to kind of slow down and take a breath. And oftentimes jiu-jitsu would remind me of that. You know, I would take a breath, I'd pause, I would, you know, my soldiers noticed too. You know, they definitely commented on, why aren't you losing your mind right now, kind of a situation. And I told them, like, I mean, inside, I guess I sort of am, but outside, I know it's not going to help the situation. And so I have to definitely show gratitude for the mentors that I had on the mats who allowed me to have that skill set, you know. And I didn't always remember to do it, but when I did, it made a big impact. And I would surprise myself, you know, because I would be this calmer version of myself in uniform, right? And it surprised me. Like, hey, okay, that really didn't get under my skin. And usually that would, right? And the benefit of that is that the soldiers weren't as stressed out as they would be if I was losing my marbles, you know? And so, and there were times I freaked out. I thought, especially if I thought one of the guys was about to get hurt, or one of the gals, because we had females in the platoon, if I'd see them in a situation that they could get themselves injured, I would freak out, you know. And then they'd yell at me like, hey, sir, chill out, it's okay, we're fine. I'm like, no, like, do not stand behind that vehicle while it's rolling downhill. There are some sketchy moments with tracks and track vehicles and stuff that just, I was like, oh Lord, you know, I do not want to get one of these guys hurt. And those were the times where, again, have to have a calm mind as a leader, like, what's the most logistical way to handle the situation quickly. Yeah. So that, again, deep breaths really helped. And then relying on the wisdom of the NCOs, the squad leaders, the ones who've been in longer than me, even if they are, you know, lower rank to an officer, they have years of wisdom on me. So how could I not, you know, respect that? So I tried to lean on them as much as possible. And yeah, we were all learning and growing, you know. It was definitely the desert, that terrain, it definitely grows you, gives you some lifelong lessons, you know.
So let's talk about the process of writing the book. Writing a book is a big endeavor, and it's a very sensitive topic in many ways. I'm sure you didn't write it just for the military audience. There's a lot of things in it that are applicable to any leader in any organization. And I think that's really important, because the military is this microcosm of where you can control the environment and you can control the people that are in it. And to a large degree, out in the real world, it's a lot harder, and you're dealing with a lot of different people in different environments. And so what was that process? What was that thought process as you're writing the book, going, how do I take these lessons and these, you know, very real world, dangerous things that we're doing? And what do I tell other leaders, people that are in charge of other people, that they really should pay attention to? What was that whole process like?
So I basically envisioned myself in my younger years when I was 17 to like 23, 24, especially that was the time period of my life where I was drinking. I was trying to find friends through alcohol. I was around a lot of drugs. I was in a scene that I was not proud of, self-medicating from some issues I had that I was dissociated from. And so I wrote this book with me in mind. And that sounds awfully self-serving, but I'll, you know, I have to be honest with you about this, because I thought if I write this book for the version of me that I'm not proud of, who was suffering and lost in a lot of ways. I saw a lot of similarities in other people, right, in the world, whether it's other soldiers, with other people I met in the corporate world. I noticed that, you know, everybody's similar to an extent. I mean, we're all human. We all know what it's like to suffer and be hurt and try to run away from pain, you know? And so I wrote this book as an encouragement and a toolkit of what to do if you're in a situation like I was, because I, ideally, and this is how I talk to my Joes, I want them to experience the least amount of that and waste the least amount of time when compared to how much time I wasted, you know, self-medicating and running away from issues. And they had so much more courage than I ever did, because they were 18 years old oftentimes, right, when they signed their contract to join the military. I mean, an 18-year-old kid, and I know they're men and women, but in my old eyes, right, they're signing contracts with also their life insurance policy. You know, if they die in training, I mean, that's a brave thing to do. And I just felt compelled to leave a resource for young folks who might feel alone and isolated and ashamed of themselves and not have the language to discuss what they're feeling inside. So this was sort of a holistic approach to leadership from a neurophysiological viewpoint, you know, and it applies to the military. It applies to any corporate structure, anywhere where you have humans leading other humans, it applies, because we all got the same brain. You know, the neurocircuitry in our heads is universal around our planet. That's the cool part about psychology. So
yeah, we do have a lot more in common than people think, you know, even different experiences, different backgrounds, but the way your body reacts, the way your mind reacts, it's science. Yes. I mean, there's variability in everything, but by and large, most people are pretty similar in how they deal with stress. And, you know, I remember hearing when I was first deploying to Iraq, the guy who talks the most crap is the first one that's going to be scared and run. And I said, wow. Really? And yeah, it was universally true. The biggest, the guy who pretended like, you know, he was overcompensating and like, you know, oh, I'm going to kill them all. Oh, I'm going to be the best. Oh. They were trying to hype themselves up because deep down they were not ready. It was always the quiet guy that would be like just watching. And then when bad things happened, they would just be the first one into action every time. It was almost like universal, like, oh, okay, I'm not going to go near that guy. He's going to get me killed. Oh. That guy, he's going to, you know, like go and bring the pain to the enemy. I'm like, universal, because it's how people are reacting, and one's getting ready and the other is trying to overcompensate. So that was Backpack to Rucksack, Insight into Leadership and Resilience for Military Experts. I know you can find it on Amazon. You can probably find it on a million other places. Go check it out. But also, Dan has a new book coming out, and I wanted to give him a chance to talk about it. I think it dropped just a day or two ago.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like a distilled version of this. So the Backpack to Rucksack book is like 400 pages long. So I kind of apologize for that. I'm a windbag when it comes to writing,
hey,
I guess.
You get, you get a good money's worth when you buy the book. You go. And it's on Kindle too, so you can get it. You know, I read a lot of books on Kindle, so.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm working on the audiobook too, but just because I feel bad people haven't read that much. But so I distilled it down a bit and created a bunch of bullet point lists based on, again, those best practices to build up resilience and whatnot. So the book I wrote is, it's called The Combat Psych Handbook. And I geared it specifically towards men. I mean, anyone can read it, but with the suicide count being, what is it, like 4x from the male to female ratio, and men tend to lack the sort of emotional language to describe feelings just innately as males. We're not so much educated on that at a young age. And so I wanted to give, especially service members and anybody who's a first responder or any guy who's tactical, who may not be super in touch with their feelings, I wanted to give them words and the ability to express what's going on inside preemptively, so that way they're not caught in a situation where they're just reacting. And so, it's about a 200-page book. It's like smaller dimensions. I haven't even received my first copy yet. I just ordered it from Amazon, but hoping it fits in the cargo pocket so guys in the field can pull it out and read it whenever they're bored. But it's, again, it was inspired by my talks with my soldiers, because we'd be in the field in the Humvee, right, or in one of the tracked vehicles, and I would just ask them, like, spitballing, you know, give me a question about psychology, give me a question about your relationships, about something you're frustrated about, and let me give you the shrink answer to it. Let me give you the psychological answer. And so we play these games where, you know, the platoon would be there and they'd just be like, all right, sir, so I experienced this with my wife. What does it mean? Or I experienced this with my dad. What does it mean? Or with my kid. And I was able to give them the, you know, neurophysiological answer to it in a way that a soldier would pick up and get. And it was so cool because you'd see their eyes light up. You know, they'd have that moment of, oh, that's what that is. That's where that aggression comes from, or that anger, or that disappointment. And it's so cool seeing that. And I thought, man, I wish every soldier could have this, you know, because it would, you know, we all know what happens when the Joes, again, go out drinking and take that aggression out, or get into a bar fight, or get behind the wheel, or whatever is, God forbid, getting a domestic dispute, you know. And I don't want to wait for stuff to happen. And I hate the punitive aspect of being a leader. I'd rather, again, give them the nurturing that they'd require to avoid that and have a stronger mindset, have a cleaner perspective, you know? So I don't mean to get super soapboxy with it or act like I have like a savior complex, but it just, I felt really compelled to put a resource in their hands, and I'm hoping this is it. The mother of she's a Gold Star mother of a soldier who died by suicide after Afghanistan. She wrote the foreword to the book. And so I got permission from her to dedicate the book to her son. And Jeremiah died because he didn't have the language to express what was going on inside. He came back from Afghanistan with some gnarly stuff, some heavy stuff on his conscience. And she saw what happened, you know, 12 years ago when he unraveled because he didn't know how to express what was going on inside. And it's a heavy story. How he died was an extremely heavy story. But I leaned into it because my soldiers had some gnarly stuff growing up. They had some pretty crazy situations that you would never expect an 18-year-old to come from. The homes that they came from, the street life that they came from at a young age. I mean, we're talking life and death stuff as middle schoolers, as high schoolers. And so I told Tammy, like, look, your son's story does not scare me, because the stuff my soldiers told me, that I stopped being scared after, you know, hearing that the 10th time. I started realizing these young guys and gals, they need us to step up as leaders.
They're not an anomaly. And no, it's everywhere. You know? It's, and I can think back to all the times, and that's the one great thing about the military is this entire salad bowl of different experiences and different backgrounds. It's not like, you know, like my kids are growing up in, surrounded by kids that are just like them out here in the country, and it's pretty quiet. And there's a fight at school, and it's like the big talk of the town. There's real life and death and drugs and abuse and neglect and all the bad things that happen to kids that then they join the military a lot of times to get away from that life. And they don't have the tools really to be able to deal with these emotions. And so they react instead of, you know, sort of plan. Yes. And that's where, in my experience, I've been to a lot, way too many autopsies, way too many death scenes. And so often it was a snap decision. There's many times where it's planned and, you know, things like that. But there's many that are very quick and it's very lethal. Soldiers know how to kill. And when they want to kill, they are very good at making sure it happens. And so the I don't want to use the word success, but the attempt versus death rate is very high just because they have guns and they know how to use them and they know how to do violence. And so it's always kind of scary. Like, I don't know anybody in the military that doesn't know someone that committed suicide, attempted suicide, or was affected by suicide. And so it's a really important thing. We're getting better at it. The 22 a day, according to the latest numbers, down to like 17. 17 is outrageously high as well, but it's trending in the right direction. I think it's because there's a lot of tools like the backpack, the rucksack, and the Combat Psych Handbook and lots of other tools out there to be able to talk about it and to form those connections and have leaders that, I don't know, give a damn. Because that's such an important component. Even if you're not like comfortable, like you're not the psychologist, you're not the person, but hey, I care about you. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Someone cares about me.
Yeah.
That might be all that's needed. Obviously, they need to go get help, but getting that first step and be able to talk about it is really important.
Yeah.
So we've talked about a lot of things, and I really appreciate both books. Guys, go check them out. We'll put links up when we post the podcast. We haven't seen the second book because Dan hasn't even seen the second book yet in the final version. That's got to be a little bit frustrating. So, Dan, we've talked about a lot of things. What should I have asked you about but didn't?
Why I'm inside of a vehicle.
Yeah, well, yeah. What are you doing inside of a vehicle in San Diego?
So I'm writing another book, a third book right now, and I'm at the cafe. I was at the cafe that I write at, and then there's a little restaurant that I go hang out for book writing part two. So, yeah, definitely. I have a training pipeline coming up next year, early in the year. So I'm trying to crank out a couple more books before I ship out. And so this is kind of like, I don't know, it's just a gift that keeps giving, you know, because of people like you who are willing to have these discussions. It made me realize maybe book writing is something I'm okay at. And it's opening the door for some awesome discussions, and it's a healing process for me. And I'm hoping it's a healing process for others. And I'm really grateful because this is the inspiration right here. You know, having these talks is where, cause you know, when you write a book, it's an isolation, you know, but when you talk about it, that's when you see people and you feel those same feelings, you connect with them. And that's what the Joes wanted. That's what soldiers wanted. They wanted to be seen, to be heard, to be understood and validated because they're human, you know, uniform or not. Every human needs this stuff.
The foundational part is that connectivity.
Yep.
And I've read some of the studies I'm a scientist. I read studies. I look at the data, and we've shifted from in-person relationships to online relationships by and large. I see it in my kids. I see it in a lot of places. And the data supports this, is that people have a community, but they don't have that in-person best friend or that in-person group. And it's definitely a different dynamic, and it's something that needs to be examined, but that in person, hey, you're a real person, not a a digital entity on the other end of a line somewhere else.
Yeah,
is really tough. It's hard to sort of break through that, and that's why, at least for our kids, we insist on sports. And go be there and make it part of a team and follow directions. And I don't care if you're bad at it; it really doesn't matter. And they're like, "But I'm horrible at X." I'm like, "Hey, you want to try something else? I don't care what sport you do, as long as you go do it, because I want them to have that in-person relationships." And so often we're not so great at it these days because it's so easy to do things like what we're doing, talking on the digital, and I'm on the other side of the country, and it's a live conversation. And I can see you, so it's almost the same thing, but it's not. And so I like books. I read a lot. And the distillation of knowledge or perspective is really important. But I do have a question, because I was thinking about it. How in the world, we've talked about why you wrote the book, but writing a book is a big endeavor. And it's not something everybody does. Have you always wanted to be a writer, or were you just led to write down your experiences and sort of consolidate your education and your experience together? What was like, how did that happen?
I mean, I like writing songs. So I love lyrics. I love the creative expression through written word. Do a lot of open mics, things of that sort. And then when I was in the Army, I worked on my master's in psychology. And then I started, a master's is really interesting because you have to look up the data, right? Peer-reviewed journal publications, and you have to cite your information. But then you get to creatively write about that. So you have the hard science, and then you get to color it in with your personality, with your perspective. You can be as dry or as elaborate as you want, as colorful as you want. You know, there's no rules. When you get a master's, you're the master of that craft. And so I noticed I was able to express myself pretty entertainingly from what I thought when I gave these talks. You know, so I'd have the research publication on the neurophysiology of being nice as a leader. And then I'd go into this example of, you know, the expression on a soldier's face when a commanding officer gives a directive, but then shows some compassion, how much more so that soldier's, you know, fired up to get the job done and complete the mission, right? So there's things of that sort. And so I was kind of flexing those or learning those new muscles, right? Training them for the first time doing the master's. And then I guess that really fed into me writing the book, because in my books, I like to throw in peer-reviewed journal publications and whatnot, so people know it's not just me blowing smoke when I write. And now there's the reason I can crank out a few books now is because I have this common framework of psychology throughout them. So whether I'm writing a book now on jujitsu and psychology and anxiety, right? So that same stuff kind of applies to the military. So resilience in uniform in the field is very much similar to resilience in jujitsu and getting choked out on the mats. I mean, so that's kind of my framework, because I'm just building off of psychology. But these are topics that are near and dear to my heart, you know, like jujitsu saved my life in a big way. The military changed my life in a big way, and the Joes, the soldiers, right? So it's really about the people that really fuels me when I write.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. I was sort of just picturing it. I write a lot, very dry academic, but the coloring in with, you know, the personality. And I was thinking back, some of my favorite things that I've read are some of these ethnographic studies where, you know, someone goes into a culture and sort of like lives it and then writes about it. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. You're
because people come to life.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
It's those idiosyncrasies.
Yes.
I remember there's an author, W.E.B. Griffin. It's kind of hokey, but it was a historical fiction writer. His son follows it on now. But he's written several series like about police and about the military. And I grew up reading these books, and they had a whole series from lieutenants to the generals, and it continues on. There's probably some still today, but he's passed away. The author has. But what drew me in was this thread of people and sort of the idiosyncrasies of the military service at the time, like everything from like how they ate and what was in the MREs or of the time, the C rations or the meals, and these sort of small things that sort of just made it more real and sort of added that character. Now, like they ate a meal. Oh no, it was all about their you know, their can opener, the P-38 broke, and then they would use this and. You know, it was just all these things that was, it made it so real and so detailed. So we've been talking with Dan Joseph. He's the author of two books, Backpack to Rucksack and the Combat Psych Handbook, which is sort of a distillation of the much larger backpack. He's got a number of other books coming out. I appreciate the fact that you talk about resilience and about your experiences while serving in uniform. It's definitely a challenge that we continue to fight to get people okay with talking about their feelings and being able to express themselves in a healthy boundary way that they're able to participate in the discussion about how they feel and understand. And this is the key that always gets me is so many issues stem from the inability to express themselves. Anger, frustration, domestic violence, self-medicating with drugs or alcohol. It's because they can't articulate in a way that feels organic and right to them. I'm going to leave you with the last word. Is there anything you'd like to share with us before we go?
Yeah, I always share about JP Lane. He's a friend of mine. He's a combat engineer who lost both of his legs in Afghanistan to a 200-pound IED. And when people see him and they thank him for his service, because he's standing there on his prosthetics, dude, total badass, you know, and he looks them in their eyes and sincerely tells them when they say, thank you for your service, what you did for our nation. He looks at him and says, you're worth it. And I mean, it, people will break down because of that response. And I told him, I was like, JP, I got to steal that from you. But I always try to give him credit for it. So if anybody out there is struggling with shame, isolation, just confusion about what's going on inside of them, frustration, just any feeling of angst, just know that you're worth it. When it comes to self-enrichment, when it comes to figuring out how to get out of that darkness and out of that place, you're worth self-care and just bettering yourself. Because whatever unit you're a part of, whether it's a family, you know, you're in a relationship with someone, as a roommate, as an employee, as a service member, everyone around you is going to benefit when you elevate yourself and you enrich yourself. So it starts with a sense of worthiness. So always try to remember that, because I know what it's like to feel unworthy of bettering myself. And I still struggle. I mean, it's definitely a journey, but if you start there, it's amazing things will happen.
We've been talking with Dan Joseph, and go check out his books. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Coming Home Well.
Thanks, Doc. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us this week on Coming Home Well with Dr. Tyler Pieron. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and a review. Thanks again. And until all are home and all are well, this is Coming Home Well.